Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. And today I'm excited to have in the studio Joe Elliott of Def Leppard.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm good, man. You're good, but you just had rotator cuff surgery.
Yeah, it's
a flesh wound. Yeah, right. No big deal.
But other than that, you're going strong. You guys have a tour coming with Journey.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Now, you've gone on tour with Journey before. They obviously don't have their original lead singer. What's it like to see them with this young guy that replaced Steve Perry? What do you make of that as someone who's stuck around so long as the original lead singer?
Well, I think when you have a band that's been around for 30, 40 years or whatever it is, it's kind of very fortunate if you can keep the same lineup together. And I'm thinking of a band like, say, U2 or something like that. We couldn't do it. We lost Pete Willis during the recording sessions of Pyromania, and Steve Clark passed away in 91. The Rolling Stones have even lost people along the way, you know. I try not to pass judgment because it's not necessarily the fault of the organization if somebody decides to leave or they get fired or whatever. And just because one person leaves, should an entire band have to shut down? I have been... I commented briefly about 3 weeks ago, and people picked up on it as though it was a negative, but it wasn't meant to be. About, you know, I got asked about the Brian Johnson situation, and I just said, look, you know, we would have managed it differently. Angus has got to do whatever Angus has got to do. I think Axl Rose did a very good job with AC/DC. Brian's my friend, so of course I'm going to go to bat for him. But the fact that he had a bit of a hearing problem, and they just decided to, like, well, okay, well, we're just going to carry on without you then. And we stuck around for Rick Allen. It's not the way we would have done things. It wasn't really meant as a criticism. It was more an observation. But I've seen Journey with a new guy, with Arnell, and he's a fantastic singer. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And if the fact is that if Steve Perry doesn't want to do it anymore, then somebody else has got to. You know, it's like a football team to a point. The quarterback quits or you get rid of him, you got to get a new one.
At the same time, if you caught your bandmates looking at, you know, cover band demo videos, you might want to
shut that down.
I might
be a little concerned about that. But, you know.
It marks the 10th anniversary this year, believe it or not, of when you guys met up with a very young Taylor Swift for an episode of CMT Crossroads, and I was rewatching that, and it's incredible. Like, you're singing her song Love Story, which has some, you know, lyrics that aren't maybe your type of lyrics, but you're really putting your heart into it. Sounds great. In fact, let's hear that right now.
On a balcony,
but what are your memories of that session 10 years ago, and what signs did you see that this young woman was going to basically conquer the world?
Well, she was already pretty big.
Yeah.
So, you know, the conquering the world was something that was either going to happen or wasn't. And in fairness, she really did go out full bore and, like, conquer the world. And good luck to her for doing that, you know. But the whole thing came together because somebody walked into our dressing room with a laptop and facing outwards, if you like, showing us, have you read this? And we went, Red what? You know, I couldn't see what it was. And so I go, it's Taylor Swift. She's doing this interview, and she said there was only one band that she would ever do a show like Crossroads with, and it was Def Leppard. And we went, wow. I said, well, okay, get in touch with her, see what she thinks, you know. And lo and behold, a couple of months go by, and all of a sudden we're doing this show, you know. And after that, it's like, well, this is interesting, because we've always been that, you know, put noses at a joint kind of band. Yeah. I love the idea of doing something that's going to either piss people off, or they go, good for you for doing something different. Because if you're going to do collaborations, I don't see the point in us doing a song with Bon Jovi. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I prefer the idea of John doing a song with, like, Tom Waits, and us doing something with, like, Loudon Wainwright III or Leonard Cohen or somebody completely off the wall. Elvis Costello and Motorhead. Can you imagine what that would sound like, you know?
I wish, yeah, that'd be awesome. Yeah.
So it's like the fact that we got hooked in with Taylor was great. You know, she was 17 years old. We were more than willing to do this. We got a new record just out. It was a bit of fun. It was a four-day project. It was 2 days of rehearsals, two shows, and everybody did their homework at home. So we turned up knowing all the chords, knowing all the lyrics, and there weren't really any difficulties. There was a couple of moments where we sat down, me and Taylor sat down, she says, I can't sing that line, because it was a bit too risque and sugar and stuff like that. So we'd swap things around. And the fact that I was actually singing from the male point of view in some of her stuff, like in Love Story, as you say, I mean, I'm not going to sing something half-hearted. I'm going to give it my all, because it doesn't matter. It's a one-off project, and you've got to sell yourself in the right light. So it makes no difference to me whether it's a Ramones song or it's Taylor Swift. I'm going to do the best I can, you know.
Fair enough. Yeah. She's a veteran now. This is how fast things
move. So what
the
hell does that make me?
Yeah.
God almighty.
A legend, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. So we sometimes do a thing on this show. We're calling it Rockstars React, where we play something very current from the pop charts and get your thoughts, if you don't mind. We want to play a song by Drake called God's Plan that literally just came out. And just what you think, if you don't mind.
I've been moving calm, don't start no trouble with me. Trying to keep it peaceful is a struggle for me. Don't pull up at 6 a.m. to cuddle with me. You know how I like it when you loving on me. I don't wanna die for them to miss me. Yes, I see the things that they wishing on me. Hope I got some brothers that outlive me. They gon' tell the story was different with me. God's plan, God's plan. I hold back, sometimes I won't, yeah. I feel good, sometimes I don't, hey.
Thoughts at all?
Mangoni. Where's the hook? Where's the hook, dude? It's kind of, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of an updated version of watching something from TV like 1971, like a Richie Havens or something like that, whereas Richie would sit on a stool, play the guitar, sing and sweat and make a bit more of an effort to perform and put melody and heart and soul into it, whereas a lot of the rap stuff, to me, it's just typewriter. You know, they've got some cool lyrical rhymes, or they actually, with a lot of rap, they don't literally rhyme maybe and baby. They take a bit more of an artistic license. As long as it's close to a rhyme, they'll use it. There's less limitations that way. But I find the lack of melody somewhat stifling in my mind, and it's nothing that I would certainly try and listen to again.
At the same time, during Hysteria, and you know, we were going to get to it, but Pour Some Sugar on Me was in some ways directly influenced by the rap at the time, wasn't
it? Yeah, but listen to the difference between that and the Drake song. Mm. You know, it was more a case of like the attitude that came out of people like the Beastie Boys and Run DMC was way more rock than that will ever be. The fact is that it had meter and it had bounce and it had melody and it had drive. And, you know, when you hear things like you got to fight for your right to party, in many respects, it's just like a poor man's AC/DC. And you got Run DMC, who they hook up with Aerosmith and basically sounded like a black Aerosmith, if you like. You know, it was, the meter was literally lifted straight off Steven Tyler. So did Steven Tyler invent rap? Debbie Harry was doing it before rap became really popular. You know, I mean, it was underground in New York.
But she was inspired by the underground black
indeed,
rappers.
Indeed, but you know, if you're from the UK like I was, we didn't know that.
Yeah,
there was
right.
no internet back then. So if there was something going on in a park in New York or in Queens or, you know, wherever, we wouldn't know that. And the first thing we hear is rapture. And it's like, oh, this is different, you know. So the way things spread these days is a lot easier for the world to grasp what it is, but everything was, it was detected by accident, or it took months and months for it to get across to certain areas of the world.
One of the things that I think made your hits so big and so interesting and so great is your openness to a lot of different kinds of music, especially in the 80s. You guys were listening to like Lionel Richie, and Thriller was an influence on Hysteria. And how did all that work for you, just like taking in all these non-rock influences?
We've always been fans of just great music. Sure. We would never limit ourselves to just listening to rock. Then you just sound like a rock band. You know what I mean? We wanted to be like Queen were. Whereas, like, you can say with Queen, they were a rock band with a bit of vaudeville and a little bit of operatic thrown in, but it was still essentially rock. We, as individuals and as a collective, would readily admit in front of the entire world to being fans of everything from the Ramones and the Pistols and the Clash, of that kind of, you know, aggressive, less musicianship kind of rock, to fans of, like, Utopia, Queen, Steely Dan, and the more musician type of rock. And then people like Peter Gabriel, Kate Bush, Tom Waits, Lionel Richie, Michael Jackson, just because they make great records. Good enough for Eddie Van Halen to play on. If it's a great song, you just go, that's a great song. You know, I mean, we were in a discotheque in Amsterdam in 1986 when we heard State of Shock by Jagger and Jackson. And we saw how it didn't empty the dance floor, but it rocked. And that's pretty much inspired Excitable off Hysteria. Just the reaction of people, like, well, you know, you can mix it up. We didn't want to sound like Saxon. We didn't want to sound like Maiden. We didn't want to sound like Duran Duran. We didn't want to sound like Depeche Mode. But if you put the lot into a bucket, there is an interlink between any one of them bands, as much as Maiden might not agree. There's a band from Sheffield called ABC. And their second album, they had this album called Beauty Stab. And in many respects, it's a very, very good rock album. But it's ABC. There's some big guitars on it, huge drums, great melodies. It's just a really good pop record. I thought that the Human League, another band from Sheffield, Martin Russian was their producer. And when they did Don't You Want Me Baby, you could tell why it was a hit. You didn't have to like it, but you could tell why it was a hit. Same thing with like a band like Depeche Mode. I've listened to Depeche Mode for 20-odd years. They're a rock band without a guitar. They're everything about them, their arrangements, the look. In fact, they did eventually bring guitar in, but even their keyboards were they were hardcore sounding, and they were playing like rock riffs on a keyboard. Nine Inch Nails, similar kind of thing. So if it's a good song, it gets logged in our DNA in the plus department. And even if all we ever do is tell people we think it's great, not lift things from it, that's a good thing. But we've always been influenced by everything from pure pop to downright hardcore rock. We would never want to be one or the other, but take the ingredients for sure. And that's how you make your own pie, by stealing ingredients from other people's recipes.
And, you know, sell 100 million records, probably.
That was a nice accident. All we ever really wanted to do was make a record that we would go out and buy ourselves. And we were one of the few bands from that era that actually would readily admit to liking things that journalists and fans may question. Because a lot of people are scared to admit their influences in case it upsets the apple cart with their audience. Jonesy, from the Pistols, and how he likes, you know, John Lydon would be like going, we hate bands like Boston and Journey and all this stuff. And he says, I'd quietly be stood at the side of him like going, well, actually, I don't. I think they're really good, you know. But, you know, it wouldn't have done them any good to admit it. And I'd read all these articles in magazines and stuff, and I remember thinking, should we ever get to the position where I'm asked that question, I'm not going to deny myself. So if somebody says, what do you think of Michael Jackson, or what do you think of Janet Jackson, or what do you think of Paula Abdul? I like the song, I like the song.
Fair enough. So you're listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Brian Hyde, and I'm in the studio right now with Joe Elliott from Def Leppard, and we'll be right back with a lot more. Wanted to talk a little bit about your live show. You're going on tour, as we mentioned, with Journey this year, and you haven't decided on the set list.
God no.
How different do you imagine it's going to be from the last set list that you went out with?
Well, it's not going to be massively different, because the thing about it's like Paul McCartney, you know, or the Rolling Stones. There are certain songs, got to play them, and I hate saying you have to play them, because he sounds like a kind of a negative. You want to play them. I've never understood the logic behind not wanting to play your hits because you're bored of it, thinking that your crowd are, or changing them up so that they're unrecognizable. You don't have the threshold to live with the fact that you've written this amazing song that you've now become bored with or something. I don't buy into that. You know, if you can't handle that responsibility of writing a hit, then don't write one. That would be my theory. So, yeah, you know, are we not going to play Sugar? Of course we are. And Photograph and Rock of Ages and Fooling. And there's the A-listers, which, as I say, you can't get out the building alive if you don't play. And then there's the B-listers, which are the important album tracks, a Fooling or a Bring On The Heartbreak, Switch 625, stuff like that. And then there's the C-list, which is songs off your latest album, deep cuts. They're the ones that you can intermingle and switch and change and maybe do a different one every night, or a different one every tour, depending on what your mood is. That is something that we'll start getting into maybe April time. I mean, we live all over the world, man. We're all over the place. But that's the great thing about communication these days. You just send out, this is my idea for a set list, and then everybody will go, okay, I'm not bothered about that one. But you'll come within one day of getting 85% of what we should be playing, right? And then you're just arguing out the other 15%. And that normally just falls into place during rehearsals.
I did have your last set list, and you know, I wanted to talk about some of the songs from it. As you said, many of them will return this time. But you've been starting off shows for a while with Let's Go from your most recent album.
Yeah, well, because it's our most recent album, we always thought the best way to get a show off the road is playing a new song, because most people are just excited to see the house lights go down. And as a fan of music that's been to thousands of shows, people are more likely to remember the end than the front. Even though you can have an incredible, spectacular intro, your hardcore fans are going to remember it. But anybody that's sitting in the back, because they know Sugar and Photograph, they're just waiting for those songs. So they're kind of like, you know, Weekend Warrior fans, if you like.
Or sure.
They ain't going to really care what you open with. You can't really justify trying to play to the collective total. You've got to make a grandstanding decision on your own artistic temperament, if you like. So it's like, look, we're promoting a new record. If certain people don't get the fact that we're going to play new music, then that's when they go and buy a beer. And then, which happens to everybody. I remember I saw this great radio broadcast of Elton John playing live for the BBC about 10 years ago. And he actually said, I am now about to mutter those words that everybody doesn't want me to mutter. Here's a song from my new album. And it's just one of those things that legacy artists have to deal with, is people come to massive arenas not to hear your new songs. But we've always taken our blueprint, if you like, off the back of a Stones bootleg. You know, you look at the Stones and they'll open with a new one, or maybe they'll open with Start Me Up and then play a new one second, and they'll go 30 minutes and they'll play another new one. And then the thing in between is Jumping Jack Flash, Gimme Shelter, Carlos Got What You Want, new song. Hit, 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 new song. And that's what we'll try and do. On the last tour, we opened it with Let's Go. I think we did Dangerous Fourth, and then we did Man Enough about middle set, just after Rock On, which is a kind of a down part of the set so that it can come back up again. It's all dynamic. And it's like, I think your audience will always indulge you 3 minutes of something they're not over familiar with, as long as you don't hit them with 23 minutes of it. Because that's when they really start to go, I didn't come here to hear this. I'll listen to it at home, and then when I get used to it, then I'll hear it live, if it's a hit, you know.
Second, you're playing Animal from Hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think, the single most difficult to record on Hysteria.
Oh, I don't know about that. But it's the one that went through the most metamorphosis. When we wrote the song, it had a completely different backing track, but the melody worked over the original backing track, and we put the song together, and you know, we'd move on to work on other songs and we'd come back to this one. And like a year into this project, in which we'd started with Steinman and Scrapped, and then we worked with Nigel Green, Mutt's engineer, and when Mutt came back onto the project, bit by bit we'd start replacing all the stuff that we thought we were keeping. And we got to this song a year after we'd first put it together, and we all just came to the conclusion that it was nearly a good song. There's something not right about it. And the backing track just sounded dated. What do you do in those situations? Well, you do what you can in the studio, which is leave the drums and the vocal up. And we played it, and Mutt had Steve, Sav, and Phil sit down and go, right, work something out to fit, because we're keeping this vocal. This is a great vocal. It's a good melody. And they came out with this whole new backing track behind it. It's a really bizarre way of working. It gave us another little area within that album that made it different. It's not all just recorded the same way. all these songs were individual projects by themselves almost, you know. So it wasn't difficult. It was just the route that we got to the finished song was bizarre.
Yeah, well, that's a great song. Let's hear Animal for a second. And now the next song you were playing is Let It Go, which has it's a great early vocal performance. How hard is it to match the young you on stage?
Well, listen to the version I sang on live in Detroit, and it's not a million miles from the original, because I've done it so many times that your throat gets into a shape. It's not like, I don't know how this one works, or you can't quite get there. It's in a decent key for me, you know. Some of the songs are harder to sing than others. Let It Go is not particularly difficult. It's fun to play. Lyrically, I've gone through love and hate relationships with it.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. So you get ready for the big C.
You know, I mean, I don't even know what that means anymore. Because it didn't represent what it means now. We were 21 years old maybe when that song got written. I'm 58, you know, I mean, I'm a different person. But when I was in my 30s, I really had a problem singing it. And then as I got older, I realized that the third person factor can come into this, and then it's just represents an earlier part of your career. So it's like if Robert Plant has a problem with a certain lyric from when he was 18, we don't. And once he gets his head around the fact that we don't, then he doesn't. And that's what I kind of went through with that song. So there was, you realize that you're kind of acting, you're playing the role as an actor. You don't have to be a mass murderer to play one, you know. And you don't, with certain songs, you don't have to believe every single word of the lyric, but at the same time you can't change it, because that's what people want. I mean, maybe, yeah, there are some artists that will do that, and there's people like Bob Dylan will turn a song inside out, but with us, we've never been that kind of band, we never will be. And I'm very comfortable with that song now, because it always sounds good when we play it.
Another new track, Dangerous, and then Foolin' from Pyromania, one of my favorites. What do you remember about that one coming together, and also about learning to play it live with all those vocal layers?
I don't remember much about writing Foolin', to be quite honest. Only thing I remember about Foolin' is I suggested the semitone change up for the bridge when it goes into the just gotta know. And then committee lyric writing on that particular song, I think it was me and Sav were just throwing ideas around off sheets of paper. Fooling bit, the stuttering thing, I think that came up because I think we'd just literally been talking about The Who. Maybe we were talking about Bachman Turner Overdrive. I don't know, there was some connection to previous stuttering songs, and it just made, it's like, you know what, that would really work on this one, because instead of singing five syllables, we'd just go for a one word and three stutters. It was just a different approach. That's about as much as I remember about the writing of it. It sounds like the intro riff sounds like it's either a Sav or a Clark lick. As for the rest of it, the Is Anybody Out There section sounds like Sav. That's the kind of thing he used to write a lot on the guitar, but I genuinely don't remember. But when it comes to the vocals, we'd sing them all for the record, and we were always about making the record, and to be damned with the live version, you know. We never wanted to limit ourselves by going, I can't do that, otherwise you'd have had no Bohemian Rhapsody. You know, I mean, you just don't limit yourselves by saying, we can't do it live. You get to the chorus, Is Anybody Out There? The there goes on forever on the record, but live, we do it really short, purely because we need to get the breath to sing the next bit, you know, and it's really high up and you've already been singing a ton of stuff, and just shortening it is no big deal. We sing the harmonies and they're right. The fact that the song's a little different in length vocally, then it doesn't really make any difference. The important thing is that the lead vocal sound still works and all the guitar parts are there. The harmonies are there or thereabouts. And trust me, our guys they're great harmonious singers, all three of them, you know. We took Rick off the job once he lost his arm so he could just concentrate on the drums. But since Vivian joined, the vocals really went up a notch. So between him, Sav and Phil, there's some great singing going off. And between the four of us, we really work all the parts out. Because on a lot of these songs, I actually sing the harmonies. I don't sing the lead vocal. Well, I'm the one that's doing the anybody out there. That's me. Nobody else can hit that. Me and Vivian sometimes. And then me and Sav will do that one. And Vivian and Phil sing the lower part. I sing the high harmony on Bring On The Heartbreak, because nobody else will be able to do it.
Love Bites, another Hysteria classic. Was the deep voice on the studio version, was that possibly inspired by Vincent Price on the Thriller title track?
No, not at all. No. That was us messing around with either a Synclavier or a Fairlight computer, which had just kind of, you know, they just developed these things and they were getting them into the studio. I was like, oh, we got to try one of those. We spent so much time on Hysteria on things that never made the record. I think Bruce Dickinson has just released a biography called What Does That Button Do? And we said that every day in the studio when we were working with Mutt. Can we turn this backwards, Mutt? Yeah, just hit the button that says reverse. And that's why you get all those noises at the beginning of, like, Rocket. The backward thing, I think, is We're Fighting for the Gods of War just turned backwards and flanged. And we did that in just so many different sections of songs. Guitar parts, drums, backward snares, backward vocals, backward everything. Nothing to do with Satan, by the way. Just a Synclavier or a Fairlight. But no, the deep voice got nothing to do with Vincent Price. It was just Mutt messing around and taking it down an octave by putting the vocal into a keyboard. So when you play a C chord, you get it in regular pitch and you hit it on the lower C and you get it down an octave. You hit it on the high C, you get it sound like Mickey Mouse. So you could find a space in between and get some really weird sounds going on.
Was the word power ballad?
No, and I hate it. It's just nonsense because it was just a slow song. So when you hear the word ballad and rock together, it just draws so many negatives. But it's like, well, then Rain Song. And so is The Long and Winding Road. And so is Angie. You know, and so is Shangri-La almost by the Kinks. Or, you know, I mean, it's just a silly word. It's just a slow song. It's not a ballad. But a ballad is, it's just been, over the years, it's just become such a negative, we just say it's a slow song because it's a great, it's our only ever number one in the US. So it's not like it's something we're not proud of. It's just a great song. It just happens to be slow, you know?
Yeah. I think everyone, hopefully now in 2018, everyone's past that, I would hope, you know?
Yeah, you'd like to think so, but they still keep going on about the mullet as well, you know? Or the ripped jeans. But I mean, the thing is, they did make an impression.
Yeah.
You know? And I've never had a worry about the mullet because, to be quite honest, Bono's and Bowie's were way worse than mine.
Armageddon It, another Hysteria song. Anything stick out in your memory about that song in the studio?
Yeah, that one went through many changes. When we first started out with that song, I remember we were doing it we were all living in a rented house in Booterstown in Dublin. And Sav came in with this real Neanderthal guitar part. And it was literally just like, and it was that for months. And eventually, Steve, I think, said, you know, we need to sex this bit up. And it wants to sound like T-Rex. And he started playing the beginning bit. So it sounded more like Get It On, you know. Well, the verse part did at least. But you got sounded way better. And it's like, okay, this is starting to take shape, you know. So it was a case of, like, we had the guts of a song, but we just keep trying to improve it all the time. The actual Neanderthal bit that Sav did would have worked as a different song. It was great. We may even use it again in the future. Who knows? You know, but it turned into a much more up-to-date song. Even though we were referencing 71, somehow it had jumped enough time for that to be uber cool again. Whereas maybe 5 years earlier, referencing T-Rex wouldn't have been cool. You know, things go around in circles like that way. It's like, it's not cool to listen to the 80s, but then it's cool again. Like the 70s sucked in the 90s, but now they're cool again, you know. And the 60s sucked in the 80s, and that's the way it works, you know. One day the 80s will be cool again. So we got the song on the go, and then we got to the chorus bit, and we couldn't think of anything to sing. And I guess, I don't know what we'd been doing, watching MTV and ZZ Top had been on, and we just started singing Gimme All Your Lovin' in the space just until we came up with some other lyrics. But the problem with doing that is when you live with it for 3 or 4 weeks, you can't unscramble an egg,
right?
You know, and we said, look, with the greatest of respect to ZZ here, who, you know, wouldn't be too happy that we're doing this, it actually sounds really good.
Yeah.
And we're changing it for the sake of changing it. Just because, I mean, it's not like they don't own the rights to those words. Gimme all your loving. That was even different to theirs, but the fact is it was a marker that we ended up leaving in place because we just couldn't think of anything any better.
Jumping ahead a little bit, two steps behind. Obviously, there's an acoustic version, an electric version. You do the acoustic version.
We've never done the electric version. In fact, the electric version was just a demo. that I wrote in 89. And when we came to doing the Euphoria album, we had so many slow songs. We had Love and Hate Collide, which came out eventually 6 years later on Vault. We had Have You Ever Needed Someone So Bad? We had Tonight. We had Two Steps Behind. And it's like, well, pick two. And cut to finishing the album off, it was kind of fashionable in the day in 92, 93 to release CD singles with three bonus tracks. And it's like, well, we've just finished a 10-track record that you consider maybe there's six singles. So now we have to come up with 18 more songs. Okay, so we went through the vaults and we found a few things. And first thing we did was record Only After Dark as a kind of a helping hand for Mick Ronson, who was going through cancer treatment and didn't have any money. So he figured record one of his songs, he can get the royalties for that. So that was the first B-side we did. And then we started to like go through the stuff that we elbowed off other records. And Two Steps Behind, it was Phil Collins who said, look, we're running out of time. Let's just do it on acoustics. Hmm. Let's just do an acoustic version. So we banged it out in like 30 minutes or something like that. I put a vocal on it, and there it was, and it went out as a B-side, and it was a B-side for a year. And then one day, we got a phone call from the powers that be that were making this movie called Last Action Hero, and they said, we're looking for a Def Leppard song, but we want something that's not really that well known. And we were just in the process of putting together the Retroactive album, which was going to feature a lot of these B-sides and stuff. In remixed form. So we sent them the cassette of all the tracks that were going to go on Retroactive and said, well, look, see if there's anything on here that you like. And Michael Kamen was a musical director.
Right.
And he didn't really hear anything until he came into work after a long weekend. And one of his secretaries was whistling this song, which obviously registered in his mind. And he says, what is that that you're singing? She says, oh, it's one of those songs off the Leppard cassette. Put it on again, and what passed him by on first listen, he listened to it, he went, oh yeah, that'll work. And then it was Two Steps Behind, and he phoned us up and he says, I've just fallen in love with your song Two Steps Behind, can I put a string arrangement on it? And we're like going, oh yeah, of course you can, please, you know, be our guest. And lo and behold, the thing came out on Columbia Records and went top 10.
Yeah,
they went number one in France and number one in South Africa and number two in Canada. And all of a sudden, this song that, seriously, Phil hadn't have said, oh, let's just do it acoustically, it wouldn't have got done, you know. Happy accidents. You got to love them.
And let's hear the version of Two Steps Behind with the strings.
Walk away. It's okay if you need to. Well, you can run, but you can never hide from the shadow that's creeping.
And Rocket, we were talking about before. I mean, there's a lot of Mutt went crazy with studio effects in that one breakdown section. There's a lot of cool stuff going on in there. I think some of that he did without you guys knowing that it was going to be in the song, right?
No, they all knew. It was only me that didn't.
Ah, okay.
That was a mad thing. When you listen to Rocket, and after all the stories that we tell about Hysteria, you'd think that whole middle section, which was like our version, it was our attempt at a 21st century version of Whole Lot of Love. It was a whole breakdown section, but instead of just orgasmic sounds and a hi-hat pedal, we wanted it to be all this mad percussive stuff. And it sounds like it should have taken forever. You know, I went into Amsterdam to buy a newspaper and I came back and it was done. I'm like, and they went, you got to come and listen to this. And all it was is that there's this low pulsing vocal thing, which again is something else, I don't know what, turned around backwards and played in a sequence and put into a sequencer. And then we put all these guitar noises over the top. We then sang some guitar noises to shadow, we did sang some bits to shadow the guitar noises, and again put some backward stuff in there. And then by then we were all throwing ideas in, because it was only the pulsating low monk voice, as I like to call it, that I wasn't there for. And then we were all like going, well, we should try try that phrase and turn it around backwards. And we would do that, you know, and it's like some of them worked and some didn't. We just keep going at it until we got stuff that really did work. But that was a fantastic song to put together. That really was a brilliant team effort. I used to frequent a sauna across the road from the hotel. It's clean, but full of ladies. It was very, very, very fun. I was having a drink with one of the ladies that had been in the sauna afterwards, and she invited me back to her barge. She lived on a boat, and she had a tape of Burundi Black, and it was playing in the background while we were having a drink, and I couldn't concentrate on anything she was saying. I was listening to this drums, and I went, and it's this like tribal African drumming thing that's like 20, 30 drummers, and it just had that collective massive sound that you hear it every day these days in Hollywood movies, you know. But back then it was pretty unusual, you know. Yeah. And this song had been a minor hit in England about 1971, so that was playing on my mind. So I've heard this before. And I remember thinking, and I said to her, can I borrow that tape? And I took it back to my hotel room and made a drum loop out of part of it. And then I started coming up with chord sequences, and I played it to the guys, and they went, cool. So we started working a song into it, and the chorus was kind of there. And then they started writing all these bits for it. But it was obviously going to be a very vocal song, because if you had to listen to it, there's barely any guitars in it when the voices are singing away. So we had the intro, and then we dropped the guitars out. And then we bring them back in for the bridge. And then they're very clever in the chorus, because on certain parts of the chorus, there's no guitar. It's just a bass hitting the note. A bit like the beginning of Pinball Wizard. You think there's this huge guitar crash. It's just Entwistle. There's no Townsend on it. And we do that on one of the hits on the Rocket chorus. And then it came to like, okay, we've got a good arrangement for the music here. Where are we going to go with this? And we had Rocket. We had the phrase Rocket. And it's like, that sounded pretty cool. He said, but, you know, Rocket what? What? Is it going to do? This is going to be like a Bowie song about space? And I don't remember which one of us, could have been me, could have been Rick, suggested that we use the song as a vehicle. Like, the rocket is the vehicle of a journey through our youth. So it became what we call a list song. You remember there used to be that song, Life is a Rock, and all they did is name every band in the world, you know, including Mott the Hoople, which I was pretty cool. Billy Joel did it with...
We Didn't Start the Fire.
That's the one, yeah. And it was that kind of vibe. In fact, I think we did it before he did, but I can't remember. And it was like, okay, so where are we going to go with this? And we just started name-dropping certain characters out of rock and roll. Whether we liked them or not wasn't relevant. Phonetically, they had to work. So Benny and the Jets, Killer Queen, Gene Genie, you know, even Jet Black, who was just the drummer from the Stranglers, you know, as far as we were concerned. There's probably an American version of Jet Black somewhere, but he was the Stranglers now. And then, of course, he got to the chorus, and it was a no-brainer to Nick Lou Reed.
Yeah,
Satellite of Love. So, you know, you got Rocket, and Satellite of Love. It's like, oh, that's just perfect. Thank you, Lou, you know.
So let's hear that song. Next up is Bringing on the Heartbreak. And what I was wondering about that is, when a monster chorus like that, what's it like to have realized you just wrote a chorus that's so arena shaking and so unforgettable?
It is, well, yeah, you put it like that. Yeah, I mean, it's not like we wake up every day going, oh, brand new day. Wow, that chorus in Heartbreak's awesome. You know, I mean, it's just nothing that you think about. You did it at the time, and then you live with it for the rest of your life. It's a decision you made, and it was a great decision, you know. The way that song started out, we wrote that song in a paper factory in Drumfield, just on the outskirts of Sheffield, sometime between the On Through the Night tour and was going into the studio to record the album. It was the intro guitar part was Pete Willis, and the rest of the song, the whole way through the rest of the song, the original demo was Steve Clark. When we got into the pre-production room in London with Mutt, we didn't change it up too much, and the intro's the same, the verse jangle is the same, the bridge is the same. Then but we didn't have a chorus. The bridge was our chorus. Mutt said it needs a bigger section. And we, between him and us, we came up with the chorus. Now, originally the song was called A Certain Heartache or something like that. And the melody is exactly the same, and the bit in the bridge where I actually sing, you know, you're bringing on the heartbreak, you're taking all the best of me, was actually exactly as it was on the demo. And it was Mutt who suggested that we, instead of singing, you know, you bring a certain heartache, he says, it's nearly good but not great. He says, how about bring in on the heartbreak? Mm. So we just changed that phrase to that, and then it just became obvious, like, it should also be the chorus.
Right.
So we kind of preempt the chorus with that lyric.
Because that, yeah, that's not a big enough sentiment to match that melody.
No, no, absolutely not.
Bring and a certain heartache in us.
No, it was very introspective, and it was very bunch of kids that kind of were nearly good. We were the unpolished diamond. Mutt Lange saw something in us that we knew was there, but we didn't know how to bring it to the surface. And he did, having worked with Foreigner and AC/DC and the Boomtown Rats and all the little known bands like the Motors and Supercharge and Graham Parker and the Rumour. He'd been doing all this for years, and we trusted him because he'd done Back in Black, for Christ's sake.
Right.
You know, Highway to Hell and Foreigner 4. So he knew how to make a song sound great. And he's always been the sixth guy. Mutt can sing, he can play, and he can write. So we would sit around, and we wouldn't alienate him from those sessions, because why would you when the guy's that good? So, yeah, some of the things that we've written, he actually wrote, you know. It was a six-man team, and that's the way we did it, you know. But that song became very anthemic. You know, it was a huge, big deal. We knew it was the song on High and Dry when it came to, like, what's the phrase? Crossover.
Sure.
We knew it was going to reach out more than just the songs like High and Dry would reach, or Let It Go, or Hit and Run. This one was going to appeal to a bigger audience, and Mutt knew that because it's this one song out of all 10 on that album that he really worked a lot more time on. The rest of the stuff was just not banged out, but he caught the energy. With that song, he made me sing that thing over and over until I got it sounding the way that he thought it needed to sound, which was beyond my capabilities to think at the time when I was 21, 22 years old. I wasn't as aware then as I obviously would become 5 or 6 years later on how you need to keep furthering yourself. And we all work better under order. It's a fact, you know, and we learned that pretty quickly working with Mutt. And then, of course, you know, it comes to the end of the song and we had this thing. And for the longest time, Mutt wanted me to write lyrics. And I said, no way. That is not a lyric song. It's an instrumental. And then what we can do with this is we can very cleverly turn this into the tag that Layla was. And, like, you know, like almost the way that Freebird is after the last lyric, or Stairway to Heaven, or any of these songs that have got big, long endings. And eventually, Mutt came around to the idea and he went, okay, fine. He just thought I was being lazy and I couldn't be bothered to write lyrics. But the melody on the guitar was just so brilliant. I just couldn't see how we'd be cluttering it up to sing on that. And I really stuck my heels in and went, nah, sorry. This is an instrumental. And I'm glad we did make that decision, because everybody actually agreed eventually. But, you know, it's a staple now. And because of circumstances beyond our control, as in Steve Clark passing away, every night it becomes kind of like a tribute to Steve, which is a really cool thing to be able to do.
This has been Rolling Stone Music Now. We were lucky enough to have Joe Elliott in the studio. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And we'll be seeing you on tour this year with Journey.
Can't wait.
We'll be back next week here on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106. In the meantime, please download us as a podcast, subscribe to us as a podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Maybe leave us a nice review on iTunes. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.